We're in the middle of talking about biological molecules, and we're specifically talking about proteins when we broke for the last lecture. We're still in proteins. I was showing you a table describing the hugely diverse set of functions that proteins perform. They do just about all the important things in cells. One of those very important functions is shown in slide 16. This is acting as an enzyme. Enzymes are biological catalysts. And a catalyst is a substance that is not a reactant in a reaction. Because remember that reactants get changed into products. So they're no longer there when the reaction occurs. That's not true for a catalyst. It's not a reactant, and therefore does not get changed into something else. But it's called a catalyst if it helps reactants out by speeding up the reaction. It makes it easier for those reactants, whatever they are, to get transformed into products. And this is really important in biology because there are thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions occurring within you, making up your metabolism. And almost all of them need to be sped up in order for them to work fast enough for you to remain alive. So just about every one of your thousands of different chemical reactions need their own kind of catalyst. And that's why a big fraction of your genes, which are instructions for how to build proteins, are specifically instructions for how to build proteins that are going to act as enzymes, which are catalysts. All right? And we see the basic operation of a catalyst in slide 16. The catalyst itself, the enzyme, is the purple thing. It's shown with a specific shape. It's a cartoon shape, of course, but like all functions of proteins, those functions, whatever they are possible because of the particular shape of that protein. Enzymes operate by interacting with a reactant, as I said, some reactant in a reaction, and in a catalyzed reaction, one that's helped by a catalyst, an enzyme, we call the reactant or reactants substrates. And we can see the binding of the substrate. In this particular example, it's sucrose, but could be just about anything. The substrate, though, whatever it is, temporarily binds to a place on the enzyme called the active site. And we'll be talking much more about enzymes in a different chapter, in a different unit. But in this case, the sucrose is being catabolized, right? It's being broken into smaller pieces. That's not necessarily how enzymes work. There are also enzymes necessary for doing the reverse, anabolism, or building bigger things out of smaller ones. But the point is, without the help of the enzyme, which isn't necessary for the reaction to occur, but without the help of the enzyme, it wouldn't occur necessarily anytime soon. And that's why they're really important in biology. Oh, but a really important part of this that I didn't mention explicitly is that since enzymes are not reactants, they don't get changed into anything else, which means after they help a substrate turn into a product, they can go, they're available again for another round. They're reusable. Now we can go on to 17 and talk about the monomers. Well, let me just mention, first of all, that remember that there are three macromolecules in biology that qualify officially as polymers, right? Everything except what? Lipids are not polymers, but the others are. And I've been using alternative names for the other ones, right? I mean, for instance, nucleic acids can also be called polynucleotides. That poly in the name tells you that they're polymers. And similarly, large carbohydrates are called polysaccharides, right? And what have I been using as an alternative name for proteins? Yeah.
Polypeptides.
Up to now, I've just been using them kind of interchangeably. But I want you to realize that those two names particularly, protein and polypeptide, are not exactly interchangeable. Sometimes they are, sometimes they mean exactly the same thing, and sometimes they don't. Okay? Now, polypeptide is a word referring to a single molecule that is a polymer made by stringing together a bunch of monomers. But in the case of a polypeptide, what are the monomers called? They're not called peptides, by the way. The peptides refer to the bonds in this case, whereas in polysaccharide, it really refers to the monomers themselves, and polynucleotide refers to the monomers, but not true in polypeptides. Polypeptides are made by stringing together what kinds of subunits or monomers? What are proteins made out of? Amino acids. Those are the monomers. Okay, even though the polymer is called polypeptide. What I'm trying to say is that polypeptide always refers to a single, however long it is, a single strand of amino acids, or a string of amino acids, okay? And some proteins contain just a single polypeptide. That's all the protein is one polypeptide made of however many amino acids. All right. In that case, then the words protein and polypeptide are exactly interchangeable. And there's a lot of proteins like that. But there are also some proteins that are more complex. And they are made out of multiple polypeptides that remain individual polypeptides, but that are associated with each other. And we call those proteins multimeric, which, notice, is really the same thing as polymer in its meaning. It means multi-part also, just like polymer does. But this is to distinguish it from a polymer, which the polypeptides that it's made out of are all individual polymers, right? So not all proteins are multimeric. But some of them are. And if they are, what makes them multimeric is that they contain at least two polypeptides. Okay? So in that case, if we're talking about a multimeric protein, then the word protein and the word polypeptide do not mean exactly the same thing. The word protein in that case refers to the entire collection, however many there are, of polypeptides. And polypeptide still refers to what it always refers to, a single string of amino acids, which would only be part of the protein in that case. You see the distinction? Well, let's talk about the amino acids themselves, which are the subunits of all this. We're looking at the general structural formula of an amino acid in slide 17. And I say general because this isn't any particular amino acid. You know that because of what? The R is ambiguous, right? The R simply means the rest of the molecule, the residue. So whatever, you can have whatever you want at position R. If everything else besides that R is exactly as it is here, then you have an amino acid. And since there are infinite number of possibilities for R, because it doesn't have to be just an atom, it can be a collection of atoms, and therefore no limit to the number of possibilities, that means there's no limit to the number of possible amino acids that can be built if you're building them in a laboratory or designing them. Okay? So no limit to amino acid numbers. But one of the most important pieces of information that points to the fact that all organisms that have ever existed on Earth have a common ancestor, the first successful lineage of cells. One of the most compelling bits of evidence pointing to that is that all organisms use the same set of 20 amino acids. So don't think that there are only 20 amino acids. We should call those 20 amino acids the biological amino acids, because those are the ones that organisms use. But if you are just chemically designing things, there's no limit to the number of amino acids. Okay, but what makes an amino acid? Well, you can see in cartoon form here, but even without these labels, you should recognize this yellow thing as a carboxyl group already, right? We've been through functional groups. And you should recognize this as an amino group. So, any amino acid is an amino acid only if there is a central carbon, and carbon has a valence of 4, right? So there needs to be 4 things connected to it, or it needs to make 4 bonds, but in this case it's 4 individual single bonds. One of those is a carboxyl group it's connected to, one of them is a hydrogen, one of them is an amino group, and the other one can be anything. And that R group is the only reason why there are multiple different kinds of amino acids, because they're identical otherwise in these other three parts of the, these other three corners of the tetrahedron, basically. Okay? Now, what do we call compounds that have a carboxyl group? Carboxylic acids. What do we call compounds that have the amino group? They're called amines. And so this means that an amino acid is both an amine and a carboxylic acid. And this is why we call them amino acids. The amino part from the amino group, the acid part from the carboxylic, the carboxyl group, making them a carboxylic acid. All right? So this is just, even though this is a molecule in itself, this is just one monomer that can be strung together with others that are also amino acids in order to build, if you have enough of them together, what would be called a polypeptide. All right? Well, let's look in 18 at the 20 biological amino acids. So these are the same 20 that all organisms use. Bacteria, sequoia trees, whatever. Now, I'm not going to go through all these, and I don't want you to memorize all these structural formulae. But notice that they are all identical except for the white shaded region, which is the R group. That's the only thing that makes amino acids different from each other. They all have a carboxyl, they have a central carbon, a hydrogen, and an amino group. Okay, well, the grayish or purple shading puts these things into different groups. So there are 20 biological amino acids, but we group them into these groups based on the fact that they, depending on their R groups, they have similar chemical properties. And the top group, as you see, are the nonpolar ones. Now, why does it make sense, even if this didn't say nonpolar, that these would be nonpolar based on their R groups? Remember, the R group's the only thing making them different. Why are these R groups, in other words, nonpolar in this group? What do you notice about the things that are shaded white?
It's all just carbon and hydrogen.
Carbon and hydrogen. In other words, they are hydrocarbon R groups, right? And hydrocarbons, in general, are nonpolar for what reason? Same electronegativity, almost exactly the same electronegativity for carbon as for hydrogen. So they share electrons equally and they are nonpolar. That makes them chemically important for that reason. Well, there are also polar groups. And notice that most of these polar group amino acids have somewhere in their R group an oxygen, which, recall, has a particularly high electronegativity because it's up there in the upper right corner. The only thing higher is fluorine. So oxygen hogs the electrons unless it's sharing them with another oxygen. That's why oxygen and hydrogen, if they form a bond, will be polar. So these ones are polar. Okay? And then there's only one more group here, although other books would put this into two separate groups. What they have in common on the bottom is that they are beyond polar, because they have a fully charged R group. It's not just a partial charge, it's a full charge. But some books will put these into two separate groups because there's two ways you can be fully charged, right? Either positively or negatively. And so there's the acidic group with negative charges and the basic group with positive charges. All right. Let's look at how these things are put together then to build bigger molecules. The same scheme as we've already talked about for all four classes. You build bigger things with what kind of reactions?
Dehydration
reaction. That's exactly what's shown here. You can tell it's a dehydration because you're taking water out, right? In the form of a hydrogen from one piece and an OH from the other piece, which becomes water. But that allows you to sew them together covalently, and that forms a bigger chunk. Now, in the specific case of building or hooking together amino acids, which means you're going to make a, technically that would be a dipeptide first, if that's all you hook together are two, and then a tripeptide. Eventually, you use the word poly when you get above probably four or five. When there are just a few, we call them oligopeptides, but more than that is a polypeptide. Anyway, you build them one amino acid at a time, though, so it's no matter how long it's going to eventually be, you start out with just one hooked to another one. An important point about this, though, that's different from how you build polysaccharides is that amino acids go together only one way. There were multiple ways that you could put sugars together, right? Monosaccharides together in their ringed form. Do you remember what I was talking about this? Because they have multiple places where there are OHs and Hs. And that's why a polysaccharide can branch, like in the animal storage polysaccharide, which is called what? Glycogen. Okay, that's a branched polymer. There are no branched polypeptides, is the point here. And that's because one amino acid can go together with another amino acid in only one way. First of all, the name of the bond is called a peptide bond. Remember, we gave other names to different covalent bonds building these other things. Let's quickly go through those. What do you call the bonds between adjacent monosaccharides? Trying to convince you that you need to go through this each night a little bit to prepare for the next test. Those are called glycosidic linkages. What do you call the bonds between a fatty acid and the glycerol within a fat? An ester linkage. Good. Well, here we're looking at peptide bonds, which are the covalent bonds that you form by using a dehydration reaction to join two amino acids together. And what I mean by specifically about there only being one way to do that is that one amino acid linked to another amino acid means that the one amino acid, its carboxyl group, is going to be connected to the amino group of the next amino acid. All right? So any given amino acid, just by itself, has an OH end and an H end. Notice the H end is associated with the amino group. The OH end is part of the carboxyl. Now that's true for a single amino acid, but when you hook them together, the entire peptide, however big it is, will also have a hydrogen at one end and an OH at the other end. All right? So there's a carboxyl end and an amino end of not only a single amino acid, but any peptide of any length. And that's the only place you can hook things on. If it's the amino end you're hooking it on, that has to be the carboxyl of the next one. So that's only one way to do that, right? And if it's the carboxyl end of the peptide you're making longer, you have to hook it on to the amino end of the next amino acid. It's still, there's only one way. So there's no branching at all in polypeptides. And what makes polypeptides different from each other, two things. One is how many amino acids they're made out of. And the other is which amino acids occupy the spaces, occupy the positions. All right? So there, so that's really the big thing. That's what makes proteins different, or polypeptides different from each other. They're their size and their sequence of amino acids. That's what gives them all their different shapes that allows them to perform their hugely different sets of functions. Some of them are enzymes, some of them are signal molecules, and so on. All the things in the table that we ended up with last time. Oh, one really important thing about this also is notice from this figure that when you hook them together with the carboxyl of one hooked to the amino of the next amino acid, that does not at all involve the so-called R group. Right? Or I should say R groups, because each amino acid has its own R group. The R group is not holding this thing together. Right? And therefore, however many amino acids you have that many R groups hanging off of the side. And they collectively make up what's called the side chain. Okay? The side chain does not at all hold the polypeptide together. Yeah?
So I see the side chain, obviously. If you look at it right there, the polypeptides going together, right? And the side chain. Is there ever a case at all where the side chains might connect to each other?
Like definitely, and we're going to look at that, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, that happens, and that's an important part of stabilizing some protein's shape. It doesn't have to happen, but it can.
Okay.
And that depends on what the actual side chains are
right.
when they get close to each other.
Okay. But as long as we can see that amino and carboxyl group and that amino acid, that we know that that is the...
We know that they're amino acids, and therefore when they're hooked together, we know that that's a peptide of some size.
Right. And then the rest of
the side. And the side chains, though, is the only reason that however long this thing is, the side chains are the only reason that it's going to fold up into a particular shape versus some other shape. So the side chains are responsible for there being different proteins with different shapes. If all amino acids were identical, then the only thing would be different about them would be how long they are, and that wouldn't really affect their shape. Okay, let's go to 20 and talk more about shape. First of all, what is another name for the shape of a protein? Given you this word before. Yeah.
So like conformation.
Conformation. Conformation is everything to function. Proteins have their functions because of their conformations. It's just another name for shape. And by shape, I'm talking about a three-dimensional shape. Okay? Well, this is just a particular example, so there's nothing really special about this example, this lysozyme. So just don't worry that it's lysozyme. That's not what's important here. What's important is that this polypeptide is depicted as what's called a ribbon model. It looks like a purple ribbon, right? Ribbon models are useful, not because it really looks like a ribbon in reality, but because the ribbon reminds you of the important fact that a single polypeptide is one continuous string of amino acids that doesn't branch, just like a ribbon doesn't branch. Okay? Now, these yellow things here are actually exactly what you were referring to. Certain R groups actually can covalently bond to other R groups within the same polypeptide, and that will lock it into a shape much better than if that did not occur. It might or might happen.
So those yellow things are technically just really the bonds.
Those represent specific kinds of bonds called disulfide bridges that we're going to look at in a different slide. So the space-filling model is also a cartoon. They don't really look like this. It's kind of closer to reality, but it doesn't really give you much information. They're just, computers can do it, so we do it nowadays, but it doesn't really remind you of the fact that it's all one string of amino acids. Now, this would be an example, though, of a case of a protein for which there is only one polypeptide making it up, and therefore the word polypeptide and protein mean exactly the same. Not all proteins are like that. Slide 21, another example of proteins. Actually, these are both proteins, but from two different entities. I don't want to say organisms because the virus is not an organism. But this is a protein from a virus, and this is a protein from your body that is important in recognizing that this is an invading protein from a virus, and therefore it's trying to protect you. Well, antibodies work like all proteins based on their shape, as I've been saying. Antibodies have a perfect shape to recognize a particular type of material that it says, this is not part of you, and we should get rid of it. Okay? And proteins are ideally suited to having all these different kinds of shapes because there's so much variety in how they're made. First of all, there's 20 different subunits you can use versus 4 for nucleic acids, for instance. And those R groups can be so entirely different that they interact chemically with each other so differently that it makes it fold up into three-dimensional space a different way depending on what the actual sequence of amino acids is. So if you were designing things, which is not how the evolution works, you could make a protein have just about any shape you want. But the shapes come directly from, or originally from, the sequence of amino acids. If you had a different sequence, even using the same amino acids, put in a different order, it would fold up into three-dimensional space differently. It would have a totally different shape. Now, this is analogous in language to using exactly the same words in different orders. Right? For instance, if you consider the sentence, what on earth are you doing? Right? That has a certain meaning. On the other hand, you can say, what are you doing on earth? Totally different meaning, right? With exactly the same words. Similarly, if you rearrange the amino acids in a different sequence, they will assume, the overall polypeptide will assume a totally different shape, and therefore either not do the job or do a totally different job. And this is what evolution has worked on. Natural selection has worked on that.
Yeah,
antibodies have a part of the antibody actually is not directly involved in recognizing.
Okay.
And it's going to be the same on each antibody.
Okay.
But there's a variable part of each antibody that is the business end of it, really, that recognizes whatever the antigen is. The thing that an antibody recognizes is called the antigen. 22 now. Now it's time to talk about the four levels of protein structure. And these words just mean first, second, third, and fourth, but they are primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. Okay? Now, I already gave you some of the information that's necessary to understand this, but let me say something a little bit different. I'm basically saying the same thing, but in a different way. Every protein has at least the first three levels of structure. Every protein has primary structure, secondary structure, and tertiary structure. For those proteins that are made out of only one polypeptide, in other words, all proteins that are not multimeric, then those three levels are the only levels of protein structure that protein has. Okay? And then for the rest of the proteins, meaning all of the multimeric proteins, by definition, they have at least two polypeptides. And by the way, they can be two identical polypeptides or different ones, and there can be more than two. But as long as there's two at least, then it's a multimeric protein. And in addition to primary, secondary, and tertiary structure, that protein will also have quaternary structure. All right. Let's define what those four are. Primary structure refers simply to the particular amino acid sequence of a polypeptide. And that's represented here by a string of beads, basically. Each bead is an amino acid, and these three-letter abbreviations are different amino acid types. Glycine, proline, threonine, and so on. Don't worry about the names of them. There's 20 biological ones, okay? So primary structure includes not only how many amino acids long the polypeptide is, but which particular one of the 20 occupies each position. All right? And by the way, when I was talking earlier about there being so many possibilities, just to give you a mathematical appreciation of that, since there are, you have 20 different biological amino acids to work with, so if you think about it as building a necklace out of beads, you have 20 different kinds of beads to choose from each time you add one bead. Right? Therefore, there's 20 choices for just a single bead, not even a string of beads. Just one bead, there's 20 possibilities already, right? How many possibilities are there for two beads? No. 400. There's 20 choices for the first, and for each of those 20 choices, there's 20 choices for the second. So it's 20 times 20. Just three, which is not even a polypeptide, just three amino acids long, is 20 times 20 times 20, right? Which is 8,000. And then 160,000 for four, and then 3.2 million just for five amino acids, which is a tiny protein, wouldn't even be called a protein. And so there's no limit to the number of proteins that exist. It's just that you're stuck with the roughly 20,000 that you have the instructions for how to build. And that's why you have your traits and other organisms have their different traits, because they make other proteins. Okay? Now anyway, that's primary structure. Simply the sequence of amino acids in a single polypeptide. Secondary structure involves two often seen repeating motifs, which are not the entire sequence, but just a subsequence within that will be a certain repeating pattern that gives them certain shapes. And there are two major shapes. One is kind of an accordion shape, folded. That's called a beta pleated sheet. And the other is an alpha helix. Helix is a corkscrew shape. And so a polypeptide doesn't actually have to include either of these, but whether or not they're included, how many there are, and where those pleated sheets and helices are, is what we call secondary structure. And that's part of the overall shape. Primary structure doesn't include any shape, right? It's just you're pretending that it's an all one linear sequence. The point is it doesn't stay spread out. Once you build it, it will fold up into three dimensions. And part of that three-dimensionality is that it might form alpha helices and beta pleated sheets. That's secondary structure. Tertiary structure is the overall three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide. So it's beyond secondary structure, whether or not there are sheets and helices. It's the overall three-dimensional shape. But look at this tertiary structure protein in the cartoon. Notice that they didn't just show you the shape, they reminded you of the fact that this is all one polypeptide still. Okay? And if that is the whole protein, then protein and polypeptide mean the same thing. If it's a multimeric protein, though, then the polypeptide is only part of it. And by the way, it's important to realize that when I'm talking about a multimeric protein made of multiple polypeptides, it is not the case that you have two different polypeptides, let's say, and you string them together end to end. That would simply be making a longer polypeptide. You'd still have one polypeptide in that case. So on a multimeric protein, however many constituent polypeptides there are, remain as individual necklaces, each with two ends. But their individual tertiary structures allow them to come together and associate into an even bigger complex called the multimeric protein. And so whatever the overall three-dimensional arrangement of the constituent polypeptides are for a multimeric protein, that's what we call the quaternary structure. Right? And a good example of that would be hemoglobin. You have millions of copies of hemoglobin in just a single red blood cell. And you have billions of red blood cells in your system. So you have billions times millions of hemoglobin. It's all the same stuff, though, because you make it the same way based on the genes for your hemoglobin, right? But it's each one of them individually is made of four polypeptides that associate with each other to form the multimeric hemoglobin.
Is there any limit in the structures, the structure?
No, there isn't. There's no rules or limits, okay. Except that. There are some places, complexes in your body that are so complex in terms of how many polypeptides are involved that they qualify as molecular machines. So there are some enzyme complexes. For instance, some enzymes are fairly simple. There are some enzyme complexes that are little molecular machines made out of proteins that do quite intricate things. Okay, now to 23. Let's talk about some sort of... Let's talk about the different kinds of bonds or bonding that can occur between R groups within a polypeptide. Notice that there's one ribbon here, so this is all one polypeptide. I said a little bit earlier that, or maybe I didn't explicitly say it, but I'll say it. All of the levels of shape that we just talked about, well, all of them except primary. Secondary, tertiary, and quaternary, if it exists, those all are a result of primary structure. Primary structure defines all the others. So the overall three-dimensional shape happens because of whatever the primary structure is. Okay. So if you imagine it, once again, as a bead of strings, you know, you throw that bead of string onto a table, it's not going to stay linear. It's going to fold up. And that means it's going to put some beads into close contact with other beads, even though they're not next to each other in the string, if it folds. Well, remember, there are R groups on each of these beads with different chemical properties, because they could be polar or nonpolar, whatever. So that's what determines the overall shape. When the string bends and puts R groups into contact with each other, some will want to interact and some won't. And that's what gives the overall polypeptide its three-dimensional shape. Here we see four different kinds of bonds or attractive forces that can occur between non-adjacent R groups within a polypeptide. You have what are called hydrophobic interactions. Now, what do you notice about the two R groups here? This is one R group, this is another. Those are nonpolar, right? Because they're hydrocarbons. They're methyl groups specifically, right? Nonpolar, I've been telling you, don't really attract each other, right? So this might seem like a contradiction. But if things are just right, they actually can have a very, very weak attractive force. Even weaker than hydrogen bonds, which are already so weak that they're not even chemical bonds, right? This is a really weak force, but it's important still. Let me quickly explain how this can happen. If you have a carbon and a hydrogen in one group and a carbon and a hydrogen in the other group, for instance, these are nonpolar, right? And here's where I'm talking about is the hydrophobic interaction. There's a sharing of electrons that's occurring, right, in each of these two bonds in the two different R groups. So that means the electrons, you never know where they are at any given moment, but they're somewhere around either the carbon or the hydrogen nucleus. If these two things get close together and there starts to be a synchronization almost, then it could be that the electrons, even though they're equally shared, the electrons in this top bond could be around the carbon at this moment, whereas in the bottom R group, the electrons could be around the hydrogen, right? And then the very next moment, it would switch this way. It could keep going back and forth like this. And that would keep these two R groups very, very tiny, but oppositely charged, right? You see what I'm saying? Because wherever the electrons are is where it would be negative. And so that keeps them together a little bit. Now, it's a tiny force, but if you have a bunch of them in the polypeptide, it can actually make a big difference. This is actually how geckos, for instance, can walk on a glass ceiling because of hydrophobic interactions between their feet and the glass. All right, so that's one thing. Much, much stronger than this is the yellow one. This is what we were looking at before in the antibody, or the lysozyme one that showed the yellow things in the ribbon model. This is a disulfide bridge. Disulfide meaning involving two sulfurs, right? Well, if you look at your table of the 20 biological amino acids that we've already blown past, one of those is called cysteine. And cysteine, as its R group, has a sulfhydryl in it. Remember that sulfhydryl is just like a hydroxyl, only with sulfur and hydrogen instead of oxygen and hydrogen, so it's an SH. This was a CH2SH by itself. And this other one was a CH2SH. So there's a cysteine here and a cysteine here, and because of the way it's bent, they come into contact. If that happens, then each of the sulfhydryls will lose its hydrogen, opening up a hole in the S ball, right? And that allows the two sulfurs to covalently bond. So this is a really strong force of attraction. It keeps them together. And this will lock the protein into shape. Very much more stable shape than other proteins. Now, not all polypeptides have this, but a lot do. You have a lot of this in your hair, which is why if you burn hair, it smells like sulfur, because there's so many sulfurs. Disulfide bonds. Weaker than that is an ionic bond. Remember, there are the charged R groups. So if you have an acidic and a basic R group, oppositely charged, they are going to attract each other just like a sodium ion and a chloride ion attract each other. And that's going to stabilize the shape. And then finally, you have hydrogen bonding also possible because you have some polar groups, right? If a polar amino acid and another polar amino acid get together, they will hydrogen bond. Now to 24. Here we're... Yeah, go ahead.
On the last line, does it... all the bonds that are used, does that affect how the shape...
It doesn't just affect it; it determines it.
Well,
but as in, like, can there be less than one kind of shape, oddly shaped?
Yeah, it's not to say that there is only one possible shape. That's actually important. If you think about a polypeptide as starting out just as a stretched out necklace of beads, if you let go of it, as long as the sequence is the same, you can make many copies of it, right? One gene tells you this is the sequence, this is how long it is, and this is the particular sequence of amino acids. So every time you use that gene, you will make an identical copy of that protein. And if you just let go of them after they're built, because of their particular R groups in that sequence, they will fold up into a particular shape, and all those copies will have the same shape. But environmental conditions matter to the shape as well, which is why if you change the temperature or the pH, like you did with the egg white thing, it can drastically affect the shape and therefore destroy the function. That's what I was talking about when I was talking about acid rain. It causes denaturation of proteins because it's a drastic change in pH. But milder changes in the conditions can have a you know, just a non-lethal change in temperature, but just a slight change in temperature, will cause them to have a different shape. And they might still work, but they won't do as good a job at that new shape. All right? But they have that shape to begin with because of the particular sequence of amino acids. That's what I meant when I said all the other levels of shape spring from primary structure. Now we can go to 24 and look at two major groupings of proteins based on their shape. So any given protein, you can qualify it as either a fibrous protein, which we see on the left an example of, or a globular protein. These are just two rough categories. Fibrous proteins are long, and so they act as fibers. And their major function is structural, right? Like collagen. Collagen is an animal protein. You have a lot of it in your skin and your nails and your hair, making it strong. They act like little ropes. On the other hand, a globular protein has a more compact, it's not particularly long in any one dimension. Now, it doesn't have to be a perfect sphere. It's just any glob. And so hemoglobin is shown here. This is the example I was giving you before of a multimeric protein. Not all globular proteins are multimeric. It can be a single polypeptide. But if it folds up compactly, then it's a globular protein. And they're usually not structural proteins, but they do any of the other jobs, like acting as signals or as receptors or as enzymes and so on. And in a lot of cases, there will be one particular place on the overall surface that has an important shape. That's how receptors work, right? There's one place on the receptor that has just the right shape to receive a ligand of some sort with a particular shape. So hemoglobin is the example of a globular protein, but it's also an example of a multimeric protein. There's four overall polypeptides, two identical copies of one and two identical copies of another. So it takes actually two genes to specify a hemoglobin. You need a gene for the one kind of polypeptide and one for the other one as well. Well, speaking of hemoglobin, in slide 25, we're looking at just how important that primary structure is, which is the particular sequence of amino acids. This is using hemoglobin as an example. And on the left, we have a normal situation. Now, I just told you that it requires two genes, and that's true. But we're looking at just part of one gene in this example. Or actually, we're not even looking at the gene. We're looking at part of the sequence of one of the two different polypeptides that are in hemoglobin. But the different shading, dark and lighter violet, are the two kinds of polypeptides. They all four have to come together in the right way to have the right shape to do the job of carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood. Right? That's the major job of red blood cells, which is why they have millions of these within one cell. That's why they lose their nucleus. Your red blood cells start out like normal cells with the nucleus and other kinds of organelles, but they lose that all to make room for as much possible hemoglobin, as much hemoglobin as possible. When they are shaped correctly, then the overall red blood cell will have the normal shape, which is a kind of a flattened jelly donut. It's called a biconcave disc. Okay, that's a normal person. In a person with sickle cell disease, which is caused by a simple mutation, just a single nucleotide within DNA is different. The rest of the sequence of DNA is completely normal. But the sequence of nucleotides in a gene is what specifies to the cell the sequence of amino acids. That's why your genes tell your cells how to build the proteins. And so just one of these amino acids ends up being the wrong one in a person with sickle cell disease. The other polypeptide, by the way, is totally normal, but the beta version, the beta globin, is almost completely correct, except that in this sixth position where it's supposed to be glutamic acid, it's valine instead. The rest of the sequence perfect, but that one difference means it folds up into three dimensions differently. Yeah.
Does it have to be the same? six or ten? The first, second, third?
No, in this disorder, it's this particular one. Yeah. But this is how mutation causes differences among individuals. Mutation just happens accidentally. And if that's a harmful thing, if it causes such a change to the protein that you can't live, then natural selection is going to phase that out, right? But every once in a while, you have a mutation that will make an even better protein, doing a better job than the so-called wild type. And those will be favored by natural selection and passed on to the next generation.
So that means that there's one of those four bonds at six, because that determines the shape, right?
Not necessarily directly at six, but how six interferes with its neighbors can interfere with whether or not one of those top four bonds is made by neighbors around six. It could be six itself, or it could be just the folding at six affects the ability of others to make those bonds. But it's a drastically different shape, and it doesn't do nearly as good a job as carrying oxygen, which is why this is a bad condition. It's bad for your health. You have a much reduced lifespan because of this. And it's called sickle cell disease because each individual hemoglobin is misshaped and they start clumping together rather than being individuals. And that causes the sickle-shaped red blood cell. Okay. 26. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, on the sickle cell I saw on the side off of it, it showed like kind of the fibrous model. Or at least it showed like that long line of right there on the right.
Yes.
Is that the, and on the, obviously on the normal hemoglobin to the left there,
yeah,
it shows the globular, right?
Well, these are globular as well. This is one globular protein, multimeric.
Right.
But because they're misshapen in their subunits, that causes separate hemoglobins to hook together. Whereas normal, they stay as separate hemoglobin multimeric proteins. Yeah, this is a big glob of misshapen hemoglobins. Now, in 26, we see a word that hopefully you remember because you already did this egg white experiment, right? Where you change the temperature and you change the pH separately, but with egg white in both cases. Egg white is almost pure protein. And what you notice is you should have noticed the same effect for both of these, right? When you boiled it became hardened egg white. When you changed the pH, it should have done the same thing. And that's because what you're really doing in both of those cases is drastically changing one of these two important variables in the environment that drastically affects the shape or conformation of the protein. When you cook food, it has a different texture, right? You can tell it's cooked, even if it's not hot. It's totally different texture, like cooked meat, for instance. And that's because what you're doing is denaturing the proteins in whatever organism that you're cooking. That organism is made of proteins, like you are. Heat it up, you change those proteins. Well, if you change the pH without even heating it up, that also changes the shape of the proteins, and that's why it gives it kind of a cooked texture, even though you didn't actually heat it up, right? Like lemon juice on raw fish. What's happening is a drastic change in shape. The normal conformation is changed to something else, and that no longer works for whatever the function is supposed to be for that protein. Because remember, shape is everything to function. Well, that loss of proper shape is called denaturation. And if it's a mild denaturation, because you haven't moved it, you know, for instance, just changing the temperature a little bit, it could be a mild enough denaturation that if all you have to do is restore the conditions, in other words, change it back to the normal temperature, and it will fold back up into its proper shape. In other words, it will renature. Renaturation restores the function. But if it's too drastic a change, like if you actually boil it or drastically change the pH, then it will be a permanent denaturation, and that is a worthless protein because it can no longer do the job it was supposed to do. All right. Now, it's not a worthless structure. Because it, like all proteins, is made out of amino acids. So the cell says, this thing's never going to work again. I'm just going to part it out. It's going to digest it into individual amino acids, which then can be used in different combinations to make a totally different protein.
What about an example of acid rain?
Yeah. Acid rain falling onto a forest means you are acidifying that environment. And therefore, with that pH change, there are proteins being denatured and therefore losing their function. And therefore, the health of the organisms suffers.
Renaturation, there could be an example with ice and water, like ice turning into water, maybe, or...
Well, no, because that's not a protein.
Oh, yeah.
That's just a phase change of a compound.
Then what would be an example of renaturation? Because I can't think of, like, denaturation, like with an egg white. Like, how would you change that back to...
Well, if you, for instance, don't cook it, but change the temperature 1 degree,
right,
it will, at a molecular level, it will be slightly different.
Right.
But if you then put it back a degree, it will go back into its original shape.
Okay.
But if it's drastic, you cook a steak, you can decide that you didn't really want it, but just letting it thaw back, cool back down to room temperature is not going to turn it back into a raw steak. That's
right.
Permanent.
Right.
That's a permanent shape change.
Okay.
Yeah.
The acid rain, it would still be renaturation because it still grows, but it doesn't grow.
It depends on how acidic it is. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily completely denature it, but even a slight denaturation, even though it could be reversed, for a while it's in that denatured state, it's still not going to work as well because it has to have a particular shape to work well. And it will be at least slightly different shape if it denatures. Now, 27. Here we have proteins helping other proteins. Some proteins do just fine right off of the assembly line. Proteins are made at, or polypeptides, I should say, are made at ribosomes within cells. That's the assembly line. So it reads the gene, or it reads the code in the RNA that came from the gene, and it says, okay, we need this amino acid next, and until it's done. All right. Some of those proteins or polypeptides coming off the assembly line will just, right in the cytosol, the main compartment of the cell, will fold up into proper shape on their own. Others need a little help because the environment of the cytosol actually interferes with them having their proper shape at first. And so to give them their own little environment away from the rest of the cytosol, there are still other proteins called chaperone proteins that form, because of their shape, little canisters. And so the canister-looking thing in this cartoon is a chaperone protein. This is a brand new polypeptide that gets fed into the interior of that, keeping it away from the rest of the cell temporarily, and that will give it the right conditions for it to fold into its proper shape, and then it'll be released, and it will be able to function.
Is that why it's called
chaperone? Yeah, it's taking care of it, yes.
I see, okay. Cool.
All right, in 28, this is one slide that is actually both the end of the protein section and the beginning of the nucleic acid section. It shows you how the two are related in terms of how they function. The overall box here represents the interior of a eukaryotic cell. How do we know it's eukaryotic? It has a nucleus, exactly. The DNA, I keep saying, instructs the cell how to build proteins, right? But that's an indirect process. So the only part of this process that directly involves DNA is a step called transcription. And we'll talk about the particulars of transcription in another chapter. But transcription really refers to reading the code that's in DNA, and the code, by the way, is the sequence of monomers that it's made out of, which are nucleotides. Whatever that sequence is then rewritten in the form of a different nucleic acid, an RNA molecule, messenger RNA. And DNA's job is done now, before any amino acid has been used. DNA's job is to just store the code, kind of like an instruction manual for how to build something, but it's in a library and it is a non-circulating text, meaning you can't check it out. So you can use it in the library and copy down the information, that's what transcription is really, and then put it back on the shelf. And that information you've copied down is like the messenger RNA molecule that's built. It's now carrying the information, and DNA's job is done. Go ahead.
Is that what the enzyme?
Messenger, yes. Messenger. Yeah. And we're going to go through this in much more detail in a different unit, but this is what's happening. Okay, so that makes, you go from one nucleic acid, DNA, to another nucleic acid, RNA, in this overall process, which is overall called gene expression. Okay. Now, messenger RNA is carrying the code. DNA's job is done. That transcription, which is what this first process is called, has to happen where the DNA is. So if it's a eukaryotic cell, that's in the nucleus. Now, I just told you a little bit ago that the assembly of the polypeptide, one amino acid at a time, occurs at ribosomes. And they are out in the cytoplasm, not in the nucleus. So obviously, the thing that's carrying the code right now, the messenger RNA, needs to get out of the nucleus and go to where the ribosomes are. This is a major reason why the nuclear envelope, as it's called, the membrane surrounding the nucleus, is full of holes, little nuclear pores. Okay, so the second part of gene expression after transcription is called translation. That's the actual assembly of the polypeptide. And that occurs out in the cytoplasm where there's a ribosome. And what happens in this case is that the messenger RNA, with its own sequence of nucleotides, tells the ribosome, this is the sequence of amino acids that you need to string together to make this polypeptide. And that's represented by the purple string of beads. The cell doesn't know how to do this unless you give it instructions that originally was in DNA, and then DNA's instructions are transcribed into messenger RNA. And then that tells the ribosome how to assemble it. Once that occurs, you have a polypeptide. Okay? And so that overall two-step process, transcription and translation, is called gene expression. So this is why it serves as both the end of the protein section of the chapter and the beginning of the nucleic acid section, because it involves both. 29 now. Now we are in the nucleic acid section, which is the last thing of the four. We've talked about the other three major kinds of biomolecules. 29 shows you just a tiny sequence of nucleotides. So this is just barely a polynucleotide because there's only four nucleotides here. That's tiny compared to most nucleotides because if you consider DNA, for instance, what we call a single DNA, which is the DNA that's in one chromosome, it's millions of nucleotides long. So this is a really tiny piece, or tiny polynucleotide. But that word polynucleotide tells you this is another polymer, right? Along with polysaccharides and polypeptides. And the word tells you what the monomers are. Polynucleotides are made out of monomers called nucleotides. Well, just as a single monomer of a protein, which is an amino acid, has parts to it, even though it's one subunit, it has parts to it, right? The carboxyl group, the amino group, and so on. Also, just a single subunit of a polynucleotide, which is a single nucleotide, can be thought of as a multi-part thing in itself. It has three major components. And that's what we see in the middle. And I might have mentioned this just offhandedly in a different lecture, but here, let's make sense of this. This is all one monomer. It's one nucleotide, but any given nucleotide has three necessary components. One of those is a pentose of some sort. Now remember when we talked about, when we were in the carbohydrate section, things that end in OSE are sugars, And pent means five, so pentose simply means a five-carbon sugar. It's not a particular substance. It's a category. And that means there's a choice here. There's two choices, basically. The pentose has to have five, but it could have, as its pentose, a sugar called ribose. That is a particular sugar. And if that's true, then the nucleotide that it's part of will be called an RNA nucleotide. RNA stands for ribonucleic acid. Okay? So it would be a ribonucleotide if the sugar is particularly ribose. The other choice is that it's deoxyribose. Right? And that's what the D in DNA stands for. So DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, and the individual nucleotides within it are called deoxynucleotides, deoxyribonucleotides. Okay? That's one part of the three making up just one subunit. There are two things connected to that pentose sugar. On one end, we have a phosphate group, which, remember, can be abbreviated P in a circle, but that's really just shorthand for the whole thing, which is a phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms making up the whole group. Okay, that's on one side of the sugar. On the other side of the sugar is the third component, and that is some sort of nitrogenous base. Nitrogenous simply meaning nitrogen-containing. All phosphate groups are identical. The sugar, I told you there's two choices, but in a polymer that is DNA, every one of the nucleotides will have deoxyribose. Okay, so they're within DNA, there's no choice of sugar and there's no choice of phosphate, they're all the same. That means the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides within DNA and different kinds of nucleotides within RNA is that the nitrogenous base can be one of several things. They all are nitrogenous, but there are multiple possibilities. And those are shown on the right side of the screen. There are five overall nitrogenous bases that are used under normal situations. There's more than five, but these are the five normal ones. But DNA uses four of those five only, and RNA uses four of those five only. So obviously there's overlap between the two, right? Because you only have five total. So you can see here that, well, I guess you can't see from this one, but the four that DNA uses are adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, the A's, T's, C's, and G's that we see as sequences in DNA literature. On the other hand, RNA uses adenine, guanine, cytosine, and uracil. They use uracil instead of thymine. Okay, so it's four and four. As far as sugar is concerned, we see the two choices on the bottom right. Ribose, the one in red here on the bottom right, notice how it is shaped. Notice its structural formula. Compare that to deoxyribose that's used in DNA. Ribose is for RNA, deoxyribose is DNA. They are almost identical, right? The only difference is at this second position, the 2' position. In ribose, that's a hydroxyl. In deoxyribose, it's just a hydrogen, and that's why it's called deoxyribose. It's just like ribose without an oxygen. Okay? And so, if we have a DNA, which is not just a nucleotide, but many nucleotides strung together, every one of those nucleotides will have deoxyribose. If we have an RNA, which is many nucleotides strung together, every sugar will be ribose instead of deoxyribose. Okay, now, 30. This is DNA, one of the two major kinds of nucleic acid. And one thing that's important, an important difference between DNA and RNA is that usually DNA is double-stranded, meaning it's made up, it's kind of like a multimeric protein in this case. Remember that a multimeric protein has individual polypeptides, and each individual polypeptide is its own polymer molecule. Well, when you string together a bunch of nucleotides to make a nucleic acid, that strand, however long it is, can be called a polynucleotide, which is itself a polymer, and it's a molecule in its own right. What we call a single DNA is really two molecules, because it's two polynucleotides. Each strand is its own polymer. And those two strands are held together, but they're not chemically bonded together. Okay, just like the polypeptides in a multimeric protein. But that's why we say the overall DNA is a double-stranded nucleic acid. On the other hand, most RNA molecules are just a single strand. And they can fold back on themselves, but they're just one strand. They're one polynucleotide. Other words we use to describe DNA are that it is not only double-stranded, but it's a double helix. And that's because in three dimensions, the strands are each corkscrew-shaped, and since there's two of them, it's a double helix. Right? Now, notice the A's, T's, C's, and G's here. Those are all representing the nitrogenous bases, right? So we don't see the sugars and the phosphates, but they're there. Every individual, any time there's an A, C, or T, or a G, there's also a sugar and a phosphate. It's just represented by that part of the ribbon. And so what holds the overall polynucleotide, one strand, one of these two ribbons, together at its length, is only the sugar and the phosphate parts of the nucleotides. Think back to the proteins. The amino acids are held together by their amino and their carboxyl group, and the R groups are not involved in holding it together at all, right? They're just hanging off to the side. Similarly, the sugar and the phosphates of adjacent nucleotides are what hold them together covalently, keeping it as a string. And the nitrogenous bases, the A's, T's, C's, and G's, are just hanging off the side. So that's true for one strand, which is itself a polynucleotide. The other strand is the same situation with its own sequence, and it's a polynucleotide on itself. And the two are held together because these nitrogenous bases form hydrogen bonding between them, which is not a chemical bond, right? So it's still two separate molecules, but we call it one DNA. And if you were to untwist this, it would look very much like a ladder, where the ribbon parts of this would be the vertical parts of the ladder, the rails of the ladder. And the pairs of nitrogenous bases, one from each of the two strands, would make up two of them together would make up one rung or step of the ladder. But it's really twisted, and that's why we call it a double helix. Now, another thing that we see might not have jumped out to you, but every time there's an A at a position on one strand, the other strand has a T. Every time there's a T, there's an A. Every time there's a C, there's a G on the other one. And every time there's a G, there's a C on the other one. So we refer to this as complementarity, with an E, not an I. So we say that the two strands are complementary to each other, which doesn't mean they give each other complements. It means that they are like inverses of each other. All right? And that is really important, because DNA wouldn't be able to do the remarkable thing that it does, which is to copy itself exactly, if it weren't for complementarity. So I think before, when first time we ever mentioned DNA in a different chapter, I think I told you that there are two major functions of DNA. Now, can you think back that far and remember what the two functions of DNA are?
Copy itself.
Right. What do we say that is in one word?
Replication,
exactly. And that's what complementarity allows it to do. We'll get into that later. What's the other major function?
Making proteins.
Yes, but there's a specific part of gene expression that we just talked about that DNA is directly involved in. What is that?
Transcription.
So replication and transcription are the two major jobs of protein. Replication is all about making another copy of DNA right before a cell divides so that the two cells it turns into will each have a full amount of DNA. And transcription is all about the lifetime of that cell when it comes time to using it as a library for how to build thousands of different kinds of proteins. All right, let's stop there.